Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is our Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As many of you come to know, not only do we rethink the week, which feels now like a year, but we begin our show every day between now and November of 2020, hearing the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman. I want to remind everyone that Colonel Vindman was the colonel who testified on Trump's phone call to Ukraine. And for a little background, just again to refresh everyone's recollection, this is from the New York Times. He fled Ukraine at age 3, became a soldier, scholar, and official at the White House. That's where he told impeachment investigators he witnessed alarming behavior by President Trump. We've all witnessed alarming behavior, and we continue to do so. Now the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his 3 sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All 3 of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, rethink the week. Oh God, is it over yet? Joining us right now are 3 fabulous guests. One of our regulars is Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a professor, a presidential scholar, a civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio, where he does their version of the end of the week. He also has a blog site called nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome to the program, Dean. How are you?
Hi, Arnie. I'm doing well.
Great. Joining us also is Rick Newman. Rick Newman, I've known him for decades, and he was a former state rep. He's originally from Canada. Am I right, Rick?
You're Canadian? That's correct.
That's right. And he's currently...
Newfoundland.
No, that's even better. Newfoundland's even better. And he is currently a lobbyist, especially for small pharmacies and the small business. And I've known him for a long time. We don't agree on a lot of things he lobbies for, but I adore his brain. Welcome to the program, Rick.
Nice to be here, Arnie.
And Glenn Smith. Glenn Smith is a phenomenal find that we got from Texas. I have to thank Scott Braddock, our fabulous editor of the Quorum Report and voice of Texas. I said to him, so who do you know? Like, who would I really like? He goes, oh, you'll love Glenn. Glenn worked on Ann Richards' first campaign for governor. He is currently, I think, are you still with Progress Texas or what is it called? And you're also kind of a consultant working with a lot of progressive candidates in Texas. Am I right?
I can do that. I'm a consultant to Progress Texas, which, as you might imagine, is a liberal activist group. And I consult to people like the new and very young county judge or chief executive of Harris County, that's Houston, Nina Hidalgo. Wow. Very proud of that.
And I want people to know that when you hear him say that he works with this judge from Harris County, we're not talking a judge that goes like this with a gavel. We're talking about someone who's more like a public official who really sort of protects and represents that county of Harris County. Am I correct?
He's like the governor of about 24 states, which are smaller than Harris County. Yeah.
Oh, see, I love it. All right. So I want to start, gentlemen, with kind of a good news story, but also an interesting reaction. I was mentioning it to our guest before we went on the air. I reached out to a young engineer a couple weeks ago, and I said, there's a guy named Dean Kamen, who's a very famous inventor, and he runs a company called DECA. And Dean Kamen is known because he created the Segway, the insulin pump. He's worked with African countries about getting them clean water without electricity. He actually created a wheelchair that goes upstairs. I mean, the guy is just, I marvel at his brain and the young engineers that he gets to work with him. But he is known nationally and internationally for something called FIRST Robotics, which is this competition with high school students all over the world where they get to sort of invent things. So he's really sort of encouraging the creative juices. He's also a good Republican and probably a billionaire. I'm sure he's very wealthy. But I saw an article in the Union Leader, which I read on Sunday. We taped the show on Sunday for Monday. And it was talking about the amazing things he is doing, not just for New Hampshire, but for the nation as well. He's using his contacts to bring in more equipment. He realizes they're going to need sterile water for a lot of the things they're going to do. He's trying to invent something to sterilize other equipment. The article is not surprising, knowing it's Dean and knowing that he's really putting all his effort in and all his engineers in. But here's the part that sort of blew me away, and I'm going to start with you, Dean. I posted it on Facebook and I said, isn't this wonderful? And then I got some really interesting reactions. So some of my lefty progressive friends were saying, oh, but he drives a Hummer and owns an island. Why would you trust him? And I'm like, excuse me? He's rich. He's successful. He's saving the world. And you're going to get pissed off because he drives a Hummer and owns an island. I said, let me introduce you to, like, you know, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. I'm sure he drives a couple of Jaguars and owns a couple of islands, but what does he do but move money around and exhaust the economy so that we have a meltdown in 2008? So in an interesting way, Dean, this sort of progressive movement that I think Bernie started in 2016, to some extent also goes to an extreme where we're putting everyone into the same sort of envelope. Yes. And that's just, that's as much a mistake as the other. Just because you're poor doesn't mean you're virtuous either, you know?
Yeah, well, and I've been arguing that for a long time, given my sort of typical positioning as a bit more of a pragmatist. And this is something I've seen afflict both the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the some parts of the Republican Party, particularly the Trumpist wing of the party. Both groups argue that it's rich against poor, us against them. If you're wealthy, if you have corporate interests, you're out to screw the little guy, et cetera, et cetera. There's no in between. There's no nuance. And I think that's just the reality. We heard that language a lot from Sanders, from Elizabeth Warren, from others. We remember Mitt Romney's famous dictum, corporations are people too, my friend. And maybe that's a little bit of an oversimplification, but this kind of sort of populist kind of division, dividing rhetoric has always been, in recent years, has always been part of the political process, and I think there is some truth to it. But as you said, it sometimes there's a risk in kind of putting everybody in the same exact boat.
So Glenn, I saw a movie many years ago, and the movie was called Crash. Ever see the movie Crash?
Yeah.
It was hard to watch because it was pretty violent. I remember having my head in my husband's armpit for most of the movie. But there was something in Crash that I wanted to show it in every evangelical church in America. I wanted to show it to every college student in America because it really recognized that we're not all one thing or another. That there, you know what I mean? And that there's this, there is the potential, even in people that we despise, that we have to recognize that on occasion, there is also virtue in them. And I use the example of how we repealed the death penalty in New Hampshire. And the story of repealing the death penalty was the story of bringing libertarians and liberals together to do a French kiss and get rid of the death penalty. And it was because libertarians don't trust government and liberals think that government shouldn't kill people. But guess what? In the end, it worked. It worked. And I'm just trying to figure out, is there a way for us to have this conversation as we move into 2020? Because I think it's going to be important for whoever is the Democratic nominee to be able to understand the mistakes that have happened, but not to do this black and white thing, which in fact is a lie anyway.
Well, I agree with you because we've talked about this before, and I'm afraid that the disease that's loose in America now may show us more than anything in recent times just how interconnected we really are.
Yes.
And how equal we are in the eyes of the virus, for instance. But we're also equal under the law. And it doesn't do any good to polarize or demonize people simply because a label somebody puts on them has a negative in our minds. Ultimately, that's going to come back and bite the name caller because we're so interconnected. I agree with Dean on the pragmatist approach to these things. Certainly, we got to do something about inequality in America because that too is a very dangerous thing. But we're not going to solve it by shouting names at one another.
So Rick, as I'm looking at this, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up is that the first article that I posted was the corona, the inequality virus. And I think that's the other thing. We've always known that we have a porous healthcare system. We know that we have the greatest gap between rich and poor. We know we're closing rural hospitals, okay? We know that if, you know, you might have insurance, but if you can't afford the deductible and you can't afford the copay, who cares if you have insurance? On paper, you're covered, but in reality, you can't exercise that coverage. And the other problem with this corona problem, this COVID problem, is that you know where the greatest deaths are going to be. And it's not going to be in wealthy suburbs, and it's not going to be in places where the elite hang out, you know, maybe in some place where there are spas. It's going to be in places like Detroit. It's going to be in places like Cook County. And that's another problem for all of us, because those people not only represent the poor of us, but they also represent the people that actually hold this economy up. You know, they're the people that do work in the restaurants, that do work in our nursing homes, that do the jobs that nobody really values, but are essential to who we are.
Yeah, and you know, the tragedy is that it's not likely that most of the people you just talked to have health insurance at all to begin with. I mean, most restaurants don't provide, you know, health coverage for their employees. And they're paying a wait staff $3.27 an hour in New Hampshire. You know, these people live on tips. The inequality virus is a good way to put it. It's not just going to adversely affect their health. The sad thing is, and it's the fault of the way they've fixed the economy or rigged the economy for folks like that. These people live on tips. Those tips don't always get reported. So now they try to collect unemployment. They're getting an unemployment check for $52 a week, where they're living on $500 or $600 a week. Now, I understand they should report all their tips, but it's the system that is set up that, you know, that kind of leads them down that road. And now we're in this crisis, and those people are being hurt the worst.
Absolutely. So as I'm looking at all these things, so I think we're now realizing the fiction of America, Dean. Okay, that, you know, all the wealth in the world, we don't have the right stockpiles. All the wealth in the world, we have so many uninsured and underinsured. All the wealth in the world, we see these just huge pockets of vulnerability. We see systems that don't work. We see leadership that doesn't exist. But I'm going to start with you, and then I'm going to toss to Glenn, because the other article that I posted was an article about Portugal. And it actually backs me into Texas as well. And the article was entitled, Portugal to Treat Migrants as Residents During Coronavirus Crisis. And I wrote, how civilized of Portugal. Now, Portugal has universal health care, unlike the United States. But by treating them as residents, what it recognizes is those migrants, not only do they live there, but they get sick too. And if you don't allow them to be treated as residents, their vulnerability will suck everything out of Portugal's ability to respond to COVID. And yet we have a president who's been othering everyone, not only migrants and undocumented immigrants, but even people of color or Muslims or whomever. I mean, whatever the other is du jour. How do we educate on this? Because we can't leave them out, because it won't work. It will just enhance this virus to even be more destructive.
Yeah, I think we have to hope that the scientists and medical professionals and epidemiologists around President Trump, to the extent that any of them have his ear, remind him that, you know, the virus doesn't check your immigration status when it infects you. And so it's a public health problem. It's not an immigration problem or a citizenship problem. And if you don't handle the problem, it has the potential to incur additional costs to society. And, you know, we talked, I think, last week about, you know, the surprise. I think people are a little bit surprised in the U.S., by kind of the failure of our public health infrastructure. We all know that we have really good private individualized healthcare. You can get any kind of advanced diagnostic if you have the right insurance that you can imagine. But it's dealing kind of with health as a threat in the health threats in the country collectively. I think people have been a little bit surprised that people got kind of caught sleeping at the switch, so to speak.
So Glenn, you live in some ways at the epicenter of this conversation because you live in Texas. You just mentioned that you are working with the woman who is running, or is she currently the Harris County judge? Is she the judge for Harris County?
Chief executive, yeah, the Harris
Chief County executive, judge. Okay. My understanding from Scott, and I've used this over and over again, is just in Houston alone, there are 600,000 undocumented immigrants, just in Houston alone. The state of Vermont has about 600,000 people. So that's the entire state of Vermont, just to give you a perspective on the number. That doesn't include the number of people that are in detention centers along the border. What are you hearing? Not necessarily from Governor Abbott, because I don't think he's offering leadership, but what are you hearing from the mayor and from the Harris County judge? What are you, the executive, what are you hearing from them about how they are gonna cope with this? Because they can't ignore those human beings, because those human beings interplay with the population at large, and those human beings get COVID too.
Well, I'm hearing good things from them. I mean, it's from like the testing sites, which aren't very many because the federal government hadn't sent them many testing equipment they need, but they're testing everybody. There's no citizenship requirement when you get through the line. Everybody gets tested, everybody gets treated. If, to the degree the facilities are available for treatment, nobody's treated differently. So that's a good sign. You know, we're kind of in a race, I think. Notice how Trump wanted to blame the Chinese, and now he's trying to single out New York, Connecticut, mm-hmm. New Jersey, as if like he just wants these terrible crowded blue states in the Northeast are responsible. So there's this othering of people, and that's very dangerous when it comes to the population you're speaking of. But has there ever been a time in America where we all are exiles and refugees at once? Don't we feel that in our homes? Should that allow us to empathize with these people that get othered by so many?
You know what? I was thinking that the other day. I was thinking about the Syrian refugees, and I'm thinking I'm in a gilded tent, okay? But I feel like a refugee as well, and I'm a very lucky refugee, but I feel exactly that way. And it's interesting because Rick, I keep thinking, how do we say that? How do we let people know that that's exactly what we all are? You know, they may have less, but in a lot of ways, we're feeling that same level or some level of vulnerability where they are. And we are demanding a response. How can you think that they don't deserve one as well? But I really do. We are all refugees. What a brilliant way of looking at it. Rick?
Yeah, there's a real inhumanity involved in not recognizing what you just said. You know, we just had yesterday here at our home delivered via Instacart groceries. I've never used it before. It worked great. You go online, you order your groceries, somebody goes and shops for you, they come and drop it off, and it's everything's done online. And then I thought about the woman who was walking away after she dropped off the groceries that we were so privileged to be able to buy in that manner. And I looked at the receipt and realized she was paid about $7 for that service. Now, the groceries were 7 miles away from me, so she had to drive 14 miles anyway, then go do the shopping, and she ends up with $7. Well, we took care of her. But I'm just saying, you talk about, we're all refugees, but you just said it. You're very lucky, so am I. There are a lot of people that are in a very difficult time right now, and I guess the point I'm getting to is the government is simply not stepping up.
No.
They're not taking care of that person who's doing that work, and they're not taking care of people who are even in worse shape than her.
Well, you know, and not only that, Dean, so you're looking at this, and I think it was Glenn that mentioned that, you know, Trump has targeted New York. He's targeted Connecticut. He's targeted New Jersey. So when I was posting this article about Portugal, I'm harsh, everyone. Be prepared. I'm harsh. I posted it this way, Dean. How sane of them, referring to what Portugal is doing vis-a-vis the migrants. We, however, are under the thumb of a self-absorbed, racist, delusional maniac who is intent on killing the other, the poor, and the urban dwellers because they vote blue. Otherwise, he would have ordered a nationwide shutdown 3 weeks ago and ordered the Defense Procurement Act at the same time. I am very harsh there. But more importantly, when he talked about somehow containing New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, so adds to the confusion, targets them, and then all of a sudden backs away. What was that about? What was it about?
I think a lot of that was posturing for his base. There's not a lot of love lost for Manhattan and the tri-state area and red rural America, and stick it to the wealthy elites on the East Coast and West Coast. And for Trump, every time he says or does something pertaining to the tri-state area, I think to my having, I grew up in New York, yeah. And I think here's an area that really fundamentally rejected him, that was so unhappy, yeah, with him, and he was so unpopular, he literally left New York to seek refuge down at Mar-a-Lago. You can't help but wonder in the back of your head is, what's the underlying motivation? Is this kind of a FU to people who rejected him? Because we know kind of how he functions. He takes all this stuff very, yeah, very personally. So yeah, I think part of that, is somebody probably whispered the quarantine idea in his head. It was kind of a virtuous signal to send to his supporters. He's not going to let the New York area people infect the rest of the country. And it's a little way to kind of, smack back at what he believes is unfair treatment by people politically in that part of the country.
But Glenn, he's becoming the secondary virus. He's becoming the secondary virus, because it's bad enough that we have to figure out whether we've got enough N95s. I mean, it's so I'm looking at this, and so you're constantly trying to figure out, is this real? Is this Memorex? Is he threatening? Is he not? He refers to the governor of Michigan as that woman. He doesn't call her governor. He refers to her as that woman, and she hasn't kissed his ring. So therefore, he doesn't like her. I am looking at this going, it is bad enough that you are melting down, trying to respond to doctors that are deciding whether they can keep a patient alive or not, or whether they're going to die going in to treat these people. You're trying to find beds. And then you've got a president who's actually creating another impediment to your ability to respond. He is the virus par deux. And that to me is shocking. And yet at the same time, his supporters still believe him. When they were doing polling numbers about whether they think this is a real dangerous virus or not, or any kind of response, they believe him. And that belief is deadly, Glenn. When do they figure it out?
I think Rick wanted to say something real quick. Rick, I saw it.
Well, though, I just wanted to pick up on what Dean said. Dean made a great point, and yet there's an irony to it about Trump playing to his supporters and talking about, trying to say, we're going to keep these New Yorkers from coming out and infecting you. And yet the effect of what he did with that quarantine statement was just the opposite, because it made people panic, and it made people in New York and New Jersey and Connecticut get out of town.
Exactly.
Afraid of being quarantined. And so, his pettiness actually probably put people's lives at risk. Sorry, Glenn.
Oh, no. Glenn, I have an Airbnb. Let me just, a little vignette. I got a request for a month, April 1st, the end of April, from some people in a very hot spot in Massachusetts. And they wanted, because they were afraid that maybe the quarantine would extend to Massachusetts next, because Rhode Island is now talking about some kind of, you can't come across the border into Rhode Island. I am looking at this and I'm going, no, you can't come. Please understand. But I mean, this is where the pressure point is. I mean, I felt guilty. But they're still working, they're sheltering in place. They just wanted to get out of Dodge. And at the same time, because we don't know about this secret virus, I don't know if they're coming to my house with the virus, and they're still employed. So I'm not gonna feel bad about them. But look what the consequences are. Everyone's trying to flee.
Glenn. If I could, if I answer your question, I like to be careful about this because of the real existence of domestic abuse. But yes, in many of those cases, and it's psychologically complex, right, the abused victim clings all the tighter to the abuser in many, many cases until something happens.
I see where you're going.
And I think that's part of the phenomenon with the believers in Trump. There's two, like I've said before on your show, for one thing, they think he's lying for them, not lying to them. Another part of it is they want a strong leader. It's cult-like, frankly. And they want to cling to the cult leader, because if you take away their cult leader, their whole self-identification disappears. It's a very complex and very dangerous circumstance, but that is certainly one of the reasons we see people clinging to Trump, even as he moves, you know, deadly moves that are going to kill people in the end.
All right. Last but not least for this segment, Dean, he wants to sign the checks that go to everyone. Yeah. I just could not believe it. He wants to sign the checks. It's like hilarious. So what's that about? Donald Trump, I mean, I got my little postcard, by the way. Everyone get their postcard? I got a postcard from the President of the United States. And my postcard from the President of the United States is telling me how to behave when COVID-19, yeah. you got one of those? So my first relationship with Donald Trump comes in a postcard about COVID-19, something he's been denying anyway. And now these checks that really are coming about in part because Democrats went apoplectic and were fighting the Republicans in the Senate and in the House, and were actually very successful to some extent, at least in the theory of the check. And now he wants to sign them.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Because, I mean, yeah, normally it gets signed by the Treasury, but this goes all the way back to 2016. I alone can fix it. That's been his mantra all along. He wants credit. He's going to expect appreciation in return. As we know, he was upset that some of the governors like Jay Inslee and the governor of Michigan were not sufficiently appreciative of his efforts. It's all part of his kind of individual psychology. This is nothing new, and it's really completely unsurprising that he would want full credit, as though the money was coming out of his bank account rather than the federal treasury into which we all pay tax dollars.
You should have seen, oh God, Rick, you love his it. I posted it on Facebook and I said, and there's going to be a little note attached. You know, this is from me to you and yours. I hope you love it. You know, I'm sure there might be another, like, you know, Christmas stocking in a couple of months. I mean, it was like he was going to own it. He wanted to put a personal note attached, maybe a chocolate kiss. Well, you know, he's brilliant at the theater.
He should have his grandchildren sign the check. They're the ones that are going to have to pay for him.
Yeah, exactly. It's just shocking. All right, everyone. This is our first half of Rethink the Week. We have three really smart people talking to us. Rick Newman, a lobbyist in New Hampshire, a former state rep. Glenn Smith, one of the best progressive consultants in Texas. And Dean Spiliotis, this is why you need a presidential scholar and a civic scholar when you're trying to figure out what the hell is going on. All right, everyone, stick around. A little Climate Connections is next. This is The Attitude.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From spinning and weaving fabric to shipping garments around the globe, the clothing industry creates a lot of carbon pollution. It's a problem made worse by the sheer volume that the industry produces and wastes. So Austin, Texas-based fashion designer Miranda Bennett wants to reduce her company's waste, starting with the fabric they use to make new items. Rather than throwing out leftover scraps of material,
we actually retain the fabric remnants that are left after our apparel is cut. We design products that specifically are created to utilize those textile remnants.
Bennett also wants to cut back on the amount of clothing that ends up in landfills at the end of its lifespan.
So much clothing ends up in landfills because there's such a diminished perception of value around the goods that people are buying, particularly from fast fashion retailers. Often goods are only worn 1 to 2 times before they're discarded, and more goods are then purchased in their place.
She strives to produce high-quality clothing that will last. And when her customers are ready to get rid of her garments, Bennett offers a discount for sending them back to the company. The items are then either donated or recycled for use in new products. So by reducing waste throughout the life of her products, she can reduce carbon pollution. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
From the Indians, welcome to pilgrims, and to the buffaloes, who once ruled a plain. Like the vultures, circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed. Sent away.
Welcome back to part deux of the Monday edition of The Attitude. Again, I want to remind everyone that we're doing this remotely via Zoom, a great technology. Thank you, Zoom. I've never met you before, but this is wonderful. And we're bringing together three voices. We're going to Rick Newman, lobbyist from New Hampshire, Dean Spiliotis, a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University, and a progressive consultant from Texas, Glenn Smith. So Glenn, I want to talk a little bit about something else. So there, this bailout bill, whatever you want to call it. It's not stimulating anything. It's bailing everything out. There is no stimulus going on. Not when you're all basically sheltering in place, at least 26 states are. But one of the things that they were able to put into this bill was some kind of oversight over the billions that will be going to very successful corporations that are suddenly claiming poverty because they didn't put the money aside. Like I was taught by my grandmother to always have a nice little place under my couch so that I always had extra cash. Instead, they expensed it out to stockholders and to executives. So now they're claiming poverty. What he is suggesting is that he's saying that he won't comply with key transparency measures in the coronavirus stimulus bill. First of all, number one, how the hell can he do that if it's real and in the bill? And number two, did this bill create enough loopholes that perhaps he could get away with what he's suggesting? And he knows it. Glenn?
Well, first of all, it means that Mnuchin was negotiating in bad faith all along. And Congress should recognize that, that by going along with the oversight function, he didn't really mean it. He thought that the House Dems had a victory, but they really didn't because he intended this all along. So there's that. I think they ought to go ahead and call it the BB Rebozo Fund now. Because of that slush fund, you know? And I think there ought to be hell to pay on Congress ought to jump him every single day about it. If we don't know where that money's going, ought to pay a big, steep price for it.
So Rick, we have the largest deficit ever, I think. You know, I mean, what is so amazing is Donald Trump keeps talking about this remarkable economy. Up until 2 months ago, it was the best economy in the world. We were just wallowing in cash. Well, I understand that his base buys his Kool-Aid. You know, they drink it. But I also understand that they come from a place where they still had to have grandmothers and they had to have grandparents and they had to have parents who said that you really need to have a savings account, whether it's a coffee can or whether it's a bank account. But the idea is that during good times, unless you're a gambler, you know, and you spend a lot of time in Nevada, you basically sort of understood you needed to put money aside. This guy, if he's right, we had the best economy. He squandered the best economy. And now we're like sinking like a financial stone. Is there a way to sell this problem by doing the math for the American people going into November of 2020? Because this is like immorality on steroids. It's not just that he lies to people. It's not that he makes, you know, governors twist in the wind. But how do you piss away a good economy and then end up with this, Rick?
Well, you know, is there a way for him to spin it? Sure. And I think he's going to do his best. We should not be surprised at all. Remember, this is a guy who literally, I mean, in tribute to another Texan, he was born on third base and thinks he hit a triple. And I mean, this guy has never had a successful business in his life. But remember, believe what people tell you about them, about themselves. He said, I love debt. There's nothing wrong with debt. And he's
right.
That every day. And before $2 trillion, the debt was already accelerating at about $1 trillion a year. And all of a sudden, the Republican Party doesn't care about that. And all of a sudden, people who cared about such things have gone silent because the economy was, you know, good.
He will spend, I predict between now and November, we will see $5-7 trillion spent in some manner in an effort to reelect Trump. And there won't be one Republican. By the way, when was the last time they tried to shut down the government to raise the debt ceiling? They must have had to done that a half a dozen times in the last year. Remember all those times tried to shut down the government because they're going to raise it? Where are those people?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So Glenn, as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking about these are potential issues for 2020. There's a lot of stuff here. This is like it's chock-a-block full of things you could take to the American people. And I don't mean his 30% base. I mean, just forget about it. I feel like you can't reach them, and that's fine until maybe death happens at their door. Maybe they think it is a fiction. But there is, I think, 50 to 60% of the American people that are feeling a level of vulnerability. So now as I'm thinking about that, how do we run an election? How do we run a campaign? I mean, we still don't even have a Democratic nominee technically yet. Between Biden and Bernie, it's still out there. It's not decided. It feels very much like it's in Biden's camp. But you've got a guy who really has almost disappeared. I don't know, when was the last time you heard from Biden? I have to Google Biden to find out what he's doing, but I don't hear from Biden. So how does a Biden, if assuming he becomes the nominee, how does he run a campaign when, can I be honest with you? His campaign for the primary sucked. And the only thing that saved his life was Jim Clyburn. And if Jim Clyburn didn't exist in the Biden world, Biden probably wouldn't be the nominee. But he did get the Jim Clyburn to be there. The problem is there is another Jim Clyburn to pull him out of wherever he is in order to respond to Trump. So my political consultant in the family, what do you suggest we do?
First of all, I think that you're going to see totally, there's not going to be much real door knocking or street or walk walking this campaign, right?
I won't let them door knock. I won't let them door knock. Go on.
It's going to be all anew and probably we hope some innovative virtual techniques where we can continually communicate to people. Honestly, this might be better for Biden than if he had to do a whole lot of personal appearances.
Absolutely.
Sort of prone to awkward speaking style, et cetera, right? So he might actually do better in this context. I think in terms of the substance from the Democratic and progressive side, I think we've got to steal a page from Ronald Reagan and just simply ask people, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Because there's not 5% of America that could answer that in the affirmative. And I think we're going to have to stay on Trump and his lack of leadership and what he's cost us in economic terms and health terms and not let him off the mat for 1 minute, despite his sort of showmanship, which we got to recognize is good. But we're going to have to match it in new and innovative ways and deliver that message start to finish.
So, Arnie, can I jump in?
I was going to you next.
I saw Joe Biden was on with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press this morning.
Oh, good. I missed it. I apologize.
Broadcasting from his basement. They got a better camera now, better lighting. It's not as kind of scary looking as some of that early streaming he was doing out of his basement. What they're basically doing, and I think there is something to be said for being able to kind of film him and edit rather than have him going off the cuff. And so they're basically just putting out a lot of digital content, ads, Biden speaking on different topics. They claim they're getting tens of millions of views of this stuff. I can't verify that. But basically, I think they realize that, you know, he can't go out and shake hands and have rallies right now. It's just not realistic. So they're just going to kind of continue to, he said he'll speak up when he feels like something needs to be said. You know, he said some very nice things about Bernie Sanders. I think that was certainly a nod to Sanders supporters. But, you know, my sense is, and he's at one point already, they've already started vetting VP nominees at some informal level. So I think he's moving on. But you're right, we're in limbo. We don't know when the primaries are going to finish. We don't know when the conventions are going to be. They may be pushed back till late August and early September like they used to be. And I think that, you know, if this is sort of a cyclical thing where it starts to ramp up again and we start to see an increase in cases in late October, early November, it's gonna act really as a form of voter suppression. If people don't have ways to vote, particularly in cities, without going to a crowded polling place, that could be a real problem.
So, hey, Rick, go on.
Story in the Atlantic today by a historian about how reminding us that states control how we pick electors to choose the president, that there's no guaranteed right to vote for the president. 30 states are controlled by Republicans. It's a distant possibility, but one that ought to be considered by people, that they could change the way they choose their electors and choose them by Republican-dominated legislators instead of popular vote. That would drop a 200 or 300 vote, electoral vote, no, 20% electoral vote advantage.
Oh my God. That was in the Atlantic Monthly this month.
Posted today or yesterday.
All right. Oh God. One more thing to give me apoplexia. So
is there a timeline on that, Glenn, when the states have to decide? Like, we had a primary already in New Hampshire.
I didn't see it mentioned in the article, the timeline, whether it'd be a deadline for them to act up on that. That's a good question.
Right. But if they control it and there are still so many states that we still have to address, guess what? If you can decide it, you can decide when it's appropriate for you to decide. You know, there might be a window of 2 weeks or 2 months, but guess what? If it's a Republican governor, Republican controlled legislature, they can amend that, you know, to suit their needs. So the reason I want to talk a little bit about Joe Biden, and I'm glad to hear that Joe Biden was on Meet the Press this morning. Rick, you know who's on every day? Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo has gotten lots and lots and lots of airtime. Andrew Cuomo has really been almost the president in exile. He has been talking to the American people. He's been talking about the facts on the ground. He isn't just really talking about New York, because even though he's using New York as his template, he really is sort of talking more about this virus and its challenge for America and the challenges that we face in getting any kind of equipment, the challenges that we face in getting more hospital beds, whatever it is. Can Biden use Andrew Cuomo, not necessarily as part of his ticket, but use him in some ways as the voice of the party going into 2020, since he really seems to be exercising the kind of leadership we would hope from a president and not getting, and yet he seems to be carrying that mantle in a pretty effective way, whether you like him or not like him. I was a big Zephyr Teachout person. You know, I'm the anti-corruption person, and you know, every once in a while, Andrew Cuomo makes me want to take a shower. But I think he's right now, I think he's our Thomas Beckett, you know, that all of a sudden, just like Beckett, is, you know, loving the king and suddenly gets this title and he challenges the king. I'm looking at Andrew Cuomo and saying, maybe this is his Beckett moment. I'll take what I got. But right now, what I got is something that sounds pretty remarkable compared to our president. Rick?
Well, I agree with you about Cuomo. I've never been a big fan. And I've talked to several people over the last couple of weeks who start a conversation with that sentence. Never been a big fan. And yet, we're looking at a guy exhibit leadership, competence, stability, some calm. I mean, kind of the things you want in a leader.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because the bar is so low. And I'm not taking anything away from the governor of New York. But the fact is that when you look at Trump, who one day we're going to open up on April 12th, and the next day we're going to quarantine New York, and then he says, oh, we sent them 30,000 ventilators, they just don't know where they are. Ridiculous comments that come out of the White House. And then you watch Andrew Cuomo, who says, if you've got a problem with the things I'm doing, blame me.
Yeah.
There's a guy taking responsibility.
Exactly. So
the question is, what does Joe Biden do with him?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, I'm a Biden supporter. I think the case could be made that Joe Biden goes to the convention and says, I'm going to step aside and turn this nomination over to Andrew Cuomo. We need his leadership today. And I'll do anything I can to help him unite this country. That would be a moment in history that something that Joe Biden could do. I'm not saying he's going to do it, but I'm just saying we all talk about uniting. We all talk about bringing people together and putting your personal ambition on the shelf. Andrew Cuomo has been leading this country for the last month.
Yeah.
And we probably ought to give some thought to whether we want him to lead us for the next 4 years.
Well, I don't smoke dope, but right about now, I love what you're saying. And I'm looking at Biden and Bernie, and I'm thinking, these are two men with egos. And if Bernie can't, yeah. And yet at the same time, so Glenn, as I'm listening to, to Rick, and then I'll, after I talk to you, I'll toss to Spiliotis. But I wrote the following, and you won't believe the interesting responses. I think I have over 200 responses, 66 comments. Here's what I wrote. I'm listening to Andrew Cuomo on TV. This was about from 3 or 4 days ago. He is our Václav Havel, MLK, and Desmond Tutu of the moment. I am crying, but I am inspired. And I have to tell you, I wish I got a clip of that moment when he was talking. And it's not every time he has a press conference. Trust me, he isn't Desmond Tutu every time. But at that moment, I was in such despair. And I heard him talking, and I hadn't heard a voice like that, an emotion like that, and an inspiration at a time when we're all terrified. And he spoke in a way that was really positive, that understood my terror. And I mean, Glenn, everyone keeps talking about his corruption and this and that, and everyone around him is in jail in Albany and all this stuff. And I don't deny it. I don't deny it, but I heard that voice, and I haven't heard that voice coming out of anyone, at least not with the kind of microphone he's been given, Glenn.
Well, you know what? His authentic style is perfect for the moment.
Yes.
And what it is this combination of compassionate, strong leadership. So he speaks to the eyes and the hearts of the people he's talking to. At the same time, it's very no-nonsense, very fact-based. Very, I'm in charge and I'm going to do the best we can do for you.
Yep.
That is a real talent. And in his case, it's not at all a pose. This is his style of speaking. And he's like, somebody said the other day, it's like being with a father and family at an Italian dinner, right? He's like in charge, but it's in this really compassionate, I'm with you sort of way. And I think that's part of the power of seeing him on television today. And I think y'all are right. I mean, he's really stepped up into a leadership position that's putting many others to shame.
So Dean, yeah. As I'm thinking about this, the other thing is, if you go back and you read, there are a whole series of articles now that are coming out about the Spanish flu of 1918 and about the mistakes that are made that almost are exactly the same mistakes that we're making now. It's just kind of amazing. But one of the things they learned from the Spanish flu was the idea that facts matter, that you have to tell people the truth, and that there's no question that it hurts to hear it. There is no question. But I remember when my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, I said, so what does this mean? He said, 16 months, Arnie, maximum 2 years. And both of us looked at each other like, we didn't want to hear that, Dean. But you know what? As I said to Marty, I said, Marty, he's not giving you a death sentence. He's giving you a life sentence. We have 16 months to squeak every bit of life out of those next 16 months. And we have to do it. And I don't want him to sugarcoat it. I'm glad he told us. And I think in a way, what Cuomo has done, maybe it's his style, but I think he's read those articles about the Spanish flu because he wants to learn from history and understand that there's actually power in learning from that.
Yeah, you know, I think particularly for Americans who are watching or parts or all of President Trump's, you know, sometimes 2 hour long daily briefings, and you're trying to kind of read the tea leaves and try to understand, you know, are they really making progress? Or are they just telling us they're making progress?
Exactly.
Where are they heading next? You know, I have found myself, you know, I haven't lived in New York in years, although my mom is still there by herself. I find myself watching those briefings as well, not intentionally. It's on and I get sucked in because you feel like, okay, give it to us straight, do it with some humanity, do it in a way that is organized in linear fashion so that we can follow. He's got those great PowerPoints that keep him from wandering, as President Trump often likes to wander. And so it's just in given how tragic the circumstances are, it's oddly refreshing. And I've seen lots of people right around the country, they're all watching him just because it feels good. It feels like, okay, if anybody's going to tell us how we're doing, he's going to tell us how we're doing, worst case scenario. And I think it's been a surprise for a lot of people. You know, I remember his father well as governor, and I had read the bad reviews of him over the years, that he's a control freak, that he's very kind of cold, etc. It really is kind of his finest hour.
Well, I think Rick, he's finding his inner father. Because yeah. Mario was such an amazing orator. Again, well, you know, and he understood, he could bring out the morality of a story and the ethics of a story. And I go back to 1991. Why do I go back to 1991, Rick? Remember when Mario Cuomo was going to run for president? And let me just give you a little sidebar. This is how New Hampshire plays such an important role in presidential politics, because I think a lot of ways you mentioned Cuomo. I don't think Andrew, I think Mario. Okay. And why do I think Mario? Because he had gone to asked Joe Grameson to run his campaign in New Hampshire. And Joe Grameson was actually at the Manchester airport waiting for Mario Cuomo to show up.
Come in on the Yankees plane.
Yes. Wait. But what you don't know, everyone, is that Joe Grameson had my campaign manager as his campaign manager 2 years before. And he called her up and told her to leave my campaign to go work for Mario Cuomo with him. And that he would pay her like an incredible amount of money. I think I was paying her $50 a week at the time. And that she should leave me. And she asked if she could take a hiatus for a time. And I said to her, I said, if you're going to leave, just leave. If you're going to stay, stay. And she spent 48 hours thinking about it. And she came back and she said, I'll stay. I said, you realize you're giving up a lot of money and an opportunity maybe to go to Washington. She said, no, I made a commitment to you. And then, of course, we know the rest of the story. Joe Grameson was waiting on the tarmac and Mario Cuomo never showed up. What I hear in Andrew Cuomo right now is a little bit of that Mario that we were waiting for on the tarmac, because that's the Cuomo that I never saw coming out of him until these last couple of weeks.
Well, we haven't had anybody in government for the last, you know, you talk about, and you think Glenn's right, you know, people, the simple question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The better question is the person leading the United States today a better person than we had 4 years ago? And that's a question. And when you see Andrew Cuomo speak, you're like somebody who's been thirsty for leadership, seeing somebody exert leadership.
Yeah.
It's one of those moments.
Yeah, no, it's shocking. Okay, last but not least, Glenn, we're going to come back to you. We asked you the tough question about what happens at the detention centers. We asked the tough question about what's going to happen to the undocumented immigrants and how they're going to be treated and whether they're going to have access. And it's not only the healthcare. Let's be honest. Those checks, those $1,200 checks, those unemployment checks, they're not going to get them. They're not going to get them. So they're going to be starving on top of the fact that they may not have access to healthcare. So there's a huge issue here. But on top of that huge issue, let me share this tweet from David K. Johnston. Here's the tweet. It was, in Detroit, chief homicide detective and jail commander dead. Police chief ill. Nearby Highland Park PD chief on a ventilator. 40 jail deputies and nurses tested positive. 400 inmates released without testing. No soap. Is there a leader out there who can help? Oh my God. We warehouse more people in prison than any other country in the world. Those prisons are going to be hotbeds of death. They're going to be places where people are going to go on a rampage. The jailers are not going to want to show up. What are we going to do?
I'll speak first about that, because in Harris County, where I'm consulting the county government on this, they were moving to release elderly and nonviolent inmates from the county jail.
Yeah.
When the governor's office in the Attorney General, Republican Attorney General, who, by the way, has been under criminal indictment for several years. He just keeps getting his court appearance delayed. But anyway,
you haven't been indicted. You haven't been invited. Isn't that what the line is? I think that's a line from Texas. Yep. Go on.
They basically did. He did an opinion saying they would oppose any effort to do that. You're raising the right question, and it goes back to what we talked about our interconnectedness. You can't leave the inmates in the jail to die without infecting the guards and the health officials and sheriff's deputies who administer to those inmates, and they're going to go back out in the community. So you're exacerbating your problem. Now, you mentioned those people kind of trapped on the border. Either they're incarcerated here or they're actually on the other side of the border without any access to health care at all. that is a tragedy just waiting to happen. And I've heard nothing from the federal government or the state government here with a really long border with Mexico moving to do anything about it. I've not heard one humanitarian mission from government officials here or the federal government.
So last comment, Dean, as we're hearing about the prison and we're hearing about the undocumented immigrants, we're hearing about those in the detention centers. Have we heard anyone in Washington, in the Senate or in the House, bring these issues up in order to let the American people know this is not a time to have ICE functioning, at least not with what they're doing now? This is not a time to sort of go back to the old anti-immigration policies that Donald Trump has celebrated, because one, it's not going to work. And two, all you're doing is pushing people farther into the shadows, just as they are even more vulnerable. They're hungry, they may be sick, they're more frightened. It seems to me that this is a time to expose this and to help them, because it means helping us. I'm going to be selfish. I'll say it's not about them. It is about me. But if you don't help them, you'll kill me.
Yeah. You know, to the extent that we're seeing these issues get any visibility, it tends to be in a very fragmented way. Either particular members of Congress, particular public interest groups that may focus in this policy domain. You know, the prison issue, I'm only seeing because occasionally on Twitter, somebody will post the infection rate at Rikers Island. It's not something I'm really hearing about in any kind of focused sort of way. So it's out there, it's kind of percolating in the environment, but it seems to have been pushed to the side a little bit. And it depends really on who you're reading and who's talking about the issue.
And you need a champion, I need to say goodbye. Rethink the Week, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Rick Newman, Dean Spiliotis, Glenn Smith. When we get back together in a couple of weeks, maybe this group will get back together. I can't imagine what we'll be talking about, but I have a funny feeling it'll be a lot of the same. Thank you so much for doing
this. Stay safe, everybody.
Stay safe. Yep,
safe.
All right.
Stay safe.
The end of the Monday edition of The Attitude. We'll talk tomorrow.
Immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in, let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and break? I can stay another day. Immigration man, I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway. There he was with his immigration face, giving me a paper chase. But the sun was coming, 'cause all at once, it looked into my eyes.